live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is going to be an empowering hour. Today, no guests, lots on health and healing, the latest on black currants. They're fresh and in season now, but unless you knew to use them, you wouldn't. They can tend to be a little tart, but there's a lot of good to them. Some new information being shared from Ann Buckley on a nutrient I believe we should be using daily. In fact, I believe we should be using it four or five times a day. I do. It's called quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. I'll show you why it's one of the most important anti-aging nutrients we have. Then I'm adding a new segment on a weekly basis to our program. It deals with human nature. So along with the environmental issues, I have something on the environment on solar storms. I'm going to be quoting solar storms from Timothy Ferris based upon the latest NASA information. I told you I would keep you up to date how long we have before the solar storms, what is the likely outcome, and the science to support it. I'm amazed at how many people I speak with who know a solar storm is coming and do nothing to prepare for it. If time permits today, I will deal with the War on Health, the FDA's Call of Tyranny, a special article by Dr. Joseph Marcola to his millions of people on his mailing list that just went out. And I thought it was very important because he gives a really good oversight on everything that's wrong with our healthcare system, and especially the FDA. But on our human nature today, I'm going to share my own insights and those also of Sarah Robinson Alternet on how the, what I call the corporate Democrats, I coined the phrase corporate Democrats and corporate Republicans, because the moment you mention Democrat or Republican, you have those individuals who are absolutely not a part of the corporate culture, nor believe in their ideologies, who will say, hold on a second, I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative, I don't believe in what they're doing. So therefore, I define those that support the Clinton corporate Democrats, those who support the corporate Bush Republicans, separately. I believe both have one agenda, to alter our educational system. As a teacher, I've taught at a school, college in New Rochelle, I've taught at the Pratt Institute, the School of Visual Arts, Fairleigh Dickinson University, where I'm a professor. I've spent my entire adult life as an educator, plus health support groups where I have to teach. And I look at what's being taught today, I'm appalled. I believe that it is their intent to alter the teaching system, controlling the paradigm, shifting the paradigm, with the outcome that we're going to have nothing but obedient, robotic students, ill-prepared to deal with the crisis in our society. Hence today, in our human nature, the first of these new series, an in-depth commentary on how both the conservatives and corporate conservatives and the liberals are destroying critical thinking, and what does it mean for our children's future and ours. So as you see, we have a lot to share. Also, the real unemployment rate, the latest from Gregory Patton from Op-Ed News. I've told you before, I felt the real unemployment rate would be around 23%, and that someone in the media surely would challenge this 8.3%, because what's not included are those who've lost their unemployment, those who are not seeking employment, who've given up, and those who are only partially employed. You add those factors in, you'll see a new number. I'm not sure I will have time today, but if not, I certainly will tomorrow. I'm going to show you the complete naked hypocrisy in a commentary from William Blum on the killinghope.org, the United States and his comrade in arms, Al-Qaeda, and other tales of an empire gone mad. Until you hear the actual facts, you will not appreciate the significance of William Blum's insights. To help you in that direction, I will play a six-minute clip from four-star General Leslie Clark, given in 2007. Now, you have not heard this before. In fact, I don't see it anywhere when I referenced it in the media before the show today. In it, and this is why this is very important, he describes one-on-one meetings with Paul Wolfowitz in 1991, before 9/11, as well as with Donald Rumsfeld, then Secretary of the Defense, where they talked at length about how they would have to go after seven countries. Those countries were Somalia, Libya, Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Now you know one of the reasons why we're in Syria, supporting the terrorists there, and also why we were in Libya. Otherwise, it would have made no sense. Listen to what he has to say. Remember, he was the Allied commander in the 1990s, up till 2000, I believe. He was personal friends with all the top Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's a four-star general. That's the top of the pecking order. So he's saying this. I want you to hear it out of his own mind and mouth. We're dealing with all the issues: environmental, health, nutrition, human nature, social, always from a progressive perspective. Let us begin. Black currants are very tart. There's red currants. They're equally tart. There's yellow currants. They're normally found in Europe. You'll find a lot of this when you go into the markets in Europe. They're generally in something of a preservative. They put them on their toast over there and bread. Here in the United States, we haven't had them as popular items in probably a century, but we should. Here's the latest in the Royal Society of Chemistry, as published in Food and Function. Quote, "The humble black currant could be the key to beating heart disease, according to a new study." Let me quote this. "The berry is full of potent antioxidants, which have been proven to slash the risk of heart attacks and stroke and heart failure. Professor Michael Avram led the research team at Rambam Medical Center in Haifa, Israel, which discovered that black currants could help cut levels of harmful fat in the body. Quote, to find such a high level of antioxidants packed into such simple berries is an exciting and significant breakthrough in heart health," end quote. Now, here's the takeaway message. Currently, there's about 70 superfoods. These are fruits and vegetables, everything from spirulina to chlorella in the vegetable family, but watercress, your cruciferous vegetables, that helps prevent cancer and stop your DNA from becoming defective. Broccoli sprouts, Brussels sprouts, dandelions, mustard, radish sprouts, daikon. These are all superfoods. Then you get your superfruits: acai, goji, noni, black raspberry, black strawberry, cherries, tart cherries. These are all superfruits. You add them all together. Rarely do you ever hear of a black currant. You should. So now, look for the black currants. Use them. I suggest them, throw them into a smoothie, because they have more vitamin C than any other fruit I'm aware of. They're really good for you. Now, in order to continue keeping your risk of diabetes down, one good way to do it: exercise and weight training. This is the latest from the Archives of Internal Medicine, University of Southern Denmark. Quote, those who lifted weights 30 minutes a day for 5 days a week substantially reduced by 34% their efforts of type 2 diabetes. Now, if they had run or bicycled in heavy gear resistance or power walked, they would have reduced their risk of diabetes by probably 90%. So lift weights, resistance exercises, and if you don't have access to a gym, you don't have weights, do push-ups. Do pull-ups. Get a bar, put it in a doorway, and then just every day just keep doing power lifts. Lift your body up. All that is good for you. Do sit-ups until you burn, It is when you get the burn, you're benefiting. This was an interesting study I found in Child Development. Here's what it says. This was done at the MIT McGovern Institute for Brain Research. It says, children's brains change as they learn to think about others. I'll quote this. Researchers have shown that activity in a certain region of the brain changes as children learn to reason about what other people might be thinking. At around the age of 5, children begin to think and reason about other people's thoughts and emotions. They start to develop a skill that scientists call theory of mind. Now a new study shows that a region of the brain that was already known to be involved in the use of this skill in adults changes its pattern of activity in children as they begin to acquire theory of mind reasoning for themselves. Rebecca Sachs, a neuroscientist at MIT, and her colleagues suggest their findings provide a good basis for studying theory of mind impairment in autistic children. But here's what I also believe it does. I believe that this research allows us to understand that children should be challenged on interpersonal communication skills, where they are taught things such as music and how to relate with people, listening, trying to interpret what people are saying, and then have someone carry on a conversation, stay neutral, write down your thoughts, then ask the person about what you interpreted what they were saying to be and get feedback. Yeah, I said that. Yeah, you got it right. No, I didn't really. And I didn't mean that, so you've taken it out of context, because how much time do we spend today correcting our thoughts or defending our thoughts because we've taken what someone said out of context that shows that we could have had much better development of our sense of reasoning skills at an earlier age? Today, almost everything is done without reasoning. They play computer games where the computer has done all the reasoning for them. All they have to do is be a passive spectator. All they have to do is employ basic skills, formalistic skills. This is absolutely counterintuitive and counter-reasonable to developing thinking skills. From Paul Fassa from Natural Society, I thought this was beneficial. I have just completed all principal photography on a major new film on vaccines. It will be the most hard-hitting, insightful vaccine film I've done. I've done two. It'll be coming out in the late fall. In it, I ask all the different scientists and physicians in the film, and everyone in the film is a woman, 47 women doctors and scientists, and I ask them a basic question. Is there any scientific justification for giving a baby whose mother is tested negative for hepatitis B to give that baby a hepatitis B vaccine? Without exception, they say the child should not ever be given that hepatitis B vaccine. And here's the latest on this. I'll quote this. If vaccines work safely, it would be prudent to screen expectant mothers for hepatitis B and exclude unnecessary hepatitis vaccines for newborns. Maybe a hep vaccine B would make any sort of sense for a newborn whose mother tested positive for hepatitis B. There are examples of acute hepatitis B among those who have been vaccinated. Those examples were from, quote, high-risk adults, young and promiscuous, and some who were exposed to hepatitis B in clinics and a hospital, what we call iatrogenic exposure. The announced removal of mercury adjuvants is a public relations distraction. Mercury-based thimerosal has been replaced by aluminum hydroxide, which also creates serious adverse neurological effects. Ironically, there is evidence of almost immediate liver damage with hepatitis B vaccine shots. Several animal studies with low doses hepatitis B vaccines have been published since the 1990s. A recent study discovered gene mutations that led to liver cell death in those that were vaccinated with the hepatitis B vaccine. This study noted that vaccine manufacturers don't test for gene mutations in their safety test. All the studies were reported in peer-reviewed journals. How does all this affect helpless infants undergoing the CDC's rigorous vaccination schedule beginning at or near birth with the hepatitis B vaccination. Renowned neurosurgeon and author Dr. Russell Blaylock puts it this way, quote, because the child's brain is undergoing a period of rapid growth from the third trimester of pregnancy until age two, his or her brain is at a considerable risk from this insane policy of infant vaccinations, end quote. The statistical evidence of rapidly rising autism and sudden infant death syndrome is overwhelming, yet only 5% of adverse events, at best, get reported to the adverse event reporting system, making it easier for the CDC to claim their low risk of to benefit vaccine ratios. Even with those cookbooks, adverse effects and deaths from human the hepatitis B vaccines greatly outnumber the hepatitis B infections and deaths among children between 10 and 14 years of age, considered the earliest age span for hepatitis B from high-risk behavior. One would get a realistic adverse event statistic by multiplying what is reported by 10. Most affected adversely don't know about this reporting system. So, the latest is don't allow your child to receive a hepatitis B vaccine if you have tested negative for the hepatitis. Next up, grape polyphenols backed by a meta-study. This means multiple studies, and this was published in the Journal of Nutrition, done at the University of Connecticut, and here's what it says. Consumption of polyphenol-rich grape may offer heart health benefits for men with metabolic syndrome. The study evaluates the effects of grape polyphenols in people with metabolic syndrome, revealing that the consumption of a freeze-dried whole grape powder led to reduction in blood pressure, improved blood flow, and reduced inflammation. By the way, metabolic syndrome refers to a cluster of conditions, including high blood pressure, raised blood sugar levels, excess body fat around the waist, and a reduction in the good HDLs. The increased blood triglycerides is bad. All that will increase your risk of a heart attack or stroke or diabetes. So here's the takeaway message. I suggest you every day you eat some grapes, preferably with seeds and skins. Now, without the seeds, it's still good, but it's not great. Better than that, have grape concentrate each day, about 3 ounces. Other than that, have 6 ounces of grape juice a day. And if you can't do any of that, just take a grape seed tablet of anywhere from 75 to 100 milligrams. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Now, let us go over to our environmental segment. I want to share with you now the latest. This time is a commentary from Timothy Ferris on solar storms. It's not long, but it's important. Here's what it says. September 1st, 1859, a 33-year-old brewer and amateur astronomer named Richard Carrington climbed the stairs to his private observatory near London, opened the dome slit, as was his habit on a Sunday morning, adjusted his telescope to project an 11-inch image of the sun on a screen. He was tracing sunspots on a piece of paper when, before his eyes, 2 patches of intensely bright white light suddenly appeared amid one large sunspot group. At the same time, the magnetometer needle dangling from a silk thread at London's Key Observatory began dancing wildly. Before dawn the next day, enormous auroral displays of red, green, and purple illuminated the skies as far south as Hawaii and Panama. Campers in the Rocky Mountains mistakenly thought the aurora for sunrise, got up and started cooking breakfast. The flare Carrington had observed heralded a solar superstorm, an enormous electromagnetic outburst that sent billions of tons of charged particles hurtling towards Earth. Another amateur English astronomer named Richard Hodgson also witnessed the flare. When the invisible wave collided with the planet's magnetic field, it caused electrical currents to surge through telegraph lines. The blast knocked out service at several stations, but telegraphers elsewhere found that they could disconnect their batteries and resume operations using the geomagnetic electricity alone. Quote, "We are working with a current from the Aurora Borealis alone," a Boston telegrapher messaged to an operator in Portland, Maine. How did you receive my writing? Quote, "Much better than with the batteries on," replied the Portland's person. Operators of today's communication systems and power grids would be less sanguine. No solar superstorm as powerful as the 1859 event has occurred since, so it is difficult to calculate what impact a comparable storm might have on today's more wired world. A hint came with the Quebec blackout on March 13, 1989, when a solar storm roughly a third less powerful than the Carrington event knocked out the power grid serving 6 million customers in less than 2 minutes' time. A Carrington-class storm could fry more transformers than the power companies keep stockpiled, leaving millions without light, potable water, sewage treatment, heating, air conditioning, fuel, telephone service, or perishable food and medications during the months it would take to manufacture and install new transformers. A recent National Academy of Sciences report estimated that such a storm could wreck the economic disruption of the 20 Katrina-class hurricanes, costing $1 to $2 trillion in the first year alone and taking a decade to recover from. Quote, "We cannot predict what the sun will do more than a few days ahead of time," laments the Lockheed Martin Solar and Astrophysics Laboratory director in Palo Alto, California. With a period of maximum solar activity expected to begin this year, remember, this year, space weather centers are adding staff and hoping for the best. Quote, "We're trying to understand how space weather percolates into society and just how bad it can get. The morally right thing to do once you have identified a threat of this magnitude is to be prepared. It's like earthquakes in San Francisco. Not preparing for it has intolerable consequences," end quote. Few objects seem as familiar as the sun. There it is, up in the sky every sunny day, yet few are so strange. Look through a solar telescope and the yellow disk is transformed into a dynamic wonderland where planet-sized prominences rise into black space like glowing jellyfish, only to loop and slither back hours or days later as if enthralled by some unseen force. As indeed they are. Neither solid, liquid, nor gas, the sun is made up of plasma, the fourth state of matter, which forms when atoms are stripped down to naked protons and electrons. All those charged particles make the solar plasma a splendid conductor of electricity, much more conducive than copper wiring. The sun is also packed with magnetic fields. Most remain buried inside the sun's massive girth, but some magnetic pipes, as thick as the earth is wide, emerge on the surface as a sunspot. This magnetism choreographs the slithering dance in the sun's atmosphere and powers the solar wind, flinging outward a million tons of plasma every second at a million miles an hour. Driving all this activity is the intriguingly intricate machinery of an unexceptional star. The sun's core, a seething 27 million degree Fahrenheit plasma, six times as dense as gold, fuses 700 million tons of protons into helium nuclei every second, releasing the energy of 10 billion hydrogen bombs in the process every second. The core throbs gently, expanding when fusion rates climb and contracting when they damp down. Superimposed on this slow, deep heartbeat are myriad other rhythms, ranging from 11-year sunspot cycles to rhythms spanning centuries. The energy produced by the fusion of the sun's core is carried outward by high-energy photons as they ricochet through a dense maze of ions and electrons. Matter is so tightly packed in this radiation zone that it takes more than 100,000 years for the protons to emerge into the surrounding convection zone, 70% of the way out from the solar center. After a month or more, the photons emerge into the photosphere, the part of the sun that we see. From there, it takes a mere 8 minutes 8 minutes for them to reach the Earth as sunlight. As one might expect, this titanic thermonuclear furnace makes a lot of noise. The sun rings like a bell in millions of distant tones, said the National Center for Atmospheric Research director in Boulder. The tones generate ripples on the solar surface, which scientists study to map currents deep in the convection zone, a discipline that is unique. Information conveyed from the heliosismic sensors aboard NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory satellite recently enabled Stanford University research to detect magnetic bundles 40,000 miles below the solar surface and to predict their emergence days later as sunspots. Such data provide crucial information on how solar storms form. The sun functions as a gigantic domino with global magnetic field lines encircling it from pole to pole like a birdcage. Now, the Carrington event consisted of a powerful solar flare that produced the second of a rare pair of coronal mass ejections, gigantic magnetic eruptions of heated plasma belched into space. The first probably reached Earth in a normal span of 40 to 60 hours, clearing a path through the solar wind for the second one to make a trip in 17 hours. Their combined impact squashed the Earth's magnetosphere, where the planet's magnetic field interacts with the solar wind, down from its normal altitude of 40,000 miles to 4,000 miles, temporarily eliminating the Van Allen radiation belts girding the planet. Charged particles entered the upper atmosphere, set off intense auroras over much of the Earth. Some people thought their cities had caught fire. A Carrington-class superstorm probably occurs only once in several centuries, but even storms of much smaller magnitude can cause considerable damage, especially as humans become increasingly dependent on technology deployed in space. Solar storms disrupt the ionosphere, the layer of Earth's atmosphere where the auroras occur, more than 60 miles above the Earth's surface. The pilots of nearly 11,000 commercial flights routed over the northern polar region each year rely on shortwave radio signals bouncing off the ionosphere to communicate above 80 degrees of latitude, beyond the range of communication satellites orbiting over the equator. When space weather disrupts the ionosphere and interrupts shortwave communications, pilots are obliged to change course, which can cost $100,000 a flight. A flustered ionosphere deranges their GPS signals as well, resulting in positioning errors that can be more than 150 feet. This means that surveyors must pack up and go home. Floating oil drilling rigs have trouble remaining on station, and pilots cannot rely on the increasingly popular GPS-based systems employed for landing at any airfield. And unlike satellites in space, most power grids have no built-in protection against the onslaught of a powerful geomagnetic storm. Since large transformers are grounded to the Earth, geomagnetic storms can induce currents that could cause them to overheat, catch fire, or explode. The damage could be catastrophic. According to John Kapperman of Storm Analysis Consultants, who studied the impact of space weather on the electrical grid, a solar storm like the one that took place in May of 1921 would today turn out the lights over half of North America. One on the order of 1859 could take out the entire grid on the entire planet, sending hundreds of millions of people back to a pre-electric way of life for weeks or months on end. In Kapperman's words, quote, "We're playing Russian roulette with the sun." Well, at least we're not playing it blindfolded. In 1859, the world had few tools for studying the sun, beyond telescopes and a handful of magnetic monitoring stations. Today, scientists constantly monitor it. Okay. Here's what is not said in this article, and here's where it can get very dangerous. Everything I just read you came from an established orthodox scientist and author. There is no controversy in anything just said. Here's the controversial part. None of our power stations have the surge protectors in place at the over 1,000 major stations and the smaller stations that could stop that kind of magnetic surge. No nuclear power plant has any of those at all. In fact, no nuclear power plant in the United States of the 104 we have, plus an additional 50 to 100 nuclear stations that produce, let's say, plutonium or nuclear weapons, have them, and they only have to have between 1 week and 4 weeks maximum of backup fuel. And they won't tell you how much backup fuel they have. We contacted Three Mile Island, and we contacted the Indian Point. No back information. So let's say they say that power could go out for weeks or months. Common sense. What would happen when the power goes out of a nuclear power plant? Well, the moment it goes out, the main reactor begins to shut down. That's good. But it means that all the power plants in America have not been able to dispose of their spent fuel rods, which are very active, having much, much more potential for disaster than what's in the plant itself. These are in pools. So you need about 2 billion gallons of water a day to cool them. It comes out of rivers or the ocean. That's why they're always on the ocean or rivers. Now, you're not going to be able to pump those because electricity would take out the pumps. Now, let's say that you have a week's worth of fuel. At the end of a week, the water starts to burn out. It's evaporating because of the high heat of the spent fuel rods. When those fuel rods are fully exposed, there's going to be a Fukushima explosion. That is not in controversy. That is an absolute, 100% gold standard. They will explode. Now, you can only do this one of two ways. You can use the nuclear power itself inside the plant, meaning the electricity the plant creates, to re-loop a circuit back in to the water pump. But that would also mean that you would have to have a separate power source completely autonomous from the plant itself. But using the plant, because remember, when the electricity goes out, the plant's power system goes down, which means the fuel that you would be normally using for that re-loop itself will be closed down. So you have to come up with new technology then to tap into another source of electricity enough to power these humongous 40-foot-wide generators. They have two of them at Indian Point to bring up that billions of gallons of water a day. No one's working on that. They don't have more than a week to a month maximum, in all likelihood a week. None of these generators have been tested for the entire time of their energy backup sources, meaning they haven't been left on for a week or a month. So we don't even know if they'd work. Now, where are you going to get the electricity, if your electricity is out, to use the equipment necessary to tool up and get a new generator built, and then to take, let's say if you have parts of a generator, to take what you have to repair one of the existing ones? A, how are you going to get it onto the highway? The highways are all going to be gigantic parking lots because no electricity means no gas pumps. No gasoline means everyone's going to steal gas or there's going to be nothing but bumper to bumper. So you couldn't even get to a nuclear power plant. Let's say you had a backup generator in Wisconsin. You had to get it to New York. It's not going to get there. Also, they have not put into any of the articles I've read, any of them, what would happen when the lights go out and the power to the nuclear power plant goes out. And the reason I believe is not because they're ignorant. I believe it's because the thought of having 104 or some part of those go into Fukushima is simply politically impossible to imagine. You would have an immediate evacuation. People would get out of their houses or sell their houses around Indian Point. And also just remember, for those of you who have thyroid cancer and you're living near a nuclear power plant, or breast cancer and you had no risk factors, it's the radiation. I'll be doing a report later this week under our new science section. I'm going to add a segment to our program on science and health. And it'll show you that all of the power plants in the United States are leaking radiation all the time, 24/7. And what that means, because we've been able to finish a report, an original investigative report showing you matching breast cancer rates in the areas, and they all are exactly around, as thyroid cancers are exactly around nuclear power plants. In any case, so let's say that you don't have power, you don't have water, you don't have food. Do you think the police are going to stick around? Do you think you're going to get FEMA how they're going to get into a city. Where's their water going to come from? Where's their electric backup generators? You've got 20 million people are going to need water and food. You're not going to have any, and you're not going to have any way to get it to them. So when I tell you that this is very serious, that there is no national discussion, and yet they're talking about things that don't matter, like who's going to win the presidential election, it doesn't matter whether it's Obama or Romney. It is irrelevant. They're both corporatists, and we all know that, at least those of us who are not afraid to look in the mirror and see the truth. But these are important issues, and shouldn't we make this a major issue? Demand that utility companies get surge protectors, even if it costs them a few billion. Demand that the nuclear power plants have reloop systems and backup generators that last a year. And immediately start manufacturing parts that were likely to be burned out that could be replaced. Your grid station is like this. You take a radio and you unplug it, you drop it in the bathtub. You let it dry, you plug it in, it works. Turn on the radio, have the electricity going to it and drop it in the bathtub. It's going to burn out. That's exactly what's going to happen to every substation and major power station in the United States. All the grids are going to burn out. Our politicians, as corrupt and banal, as stupid and conniving as they are, as in the pocket of the utility companies as they are anything else, are not making our health and our society their first priority. I suggest you raise a little hell. I have all my articles and all the substantiation on my website. Go there for further information. I'm Gary Noll. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm going to go to our next segment now. This is about human nature, and following this, I'm going to invite you to call in on our TalkBack segment and share your thoughts. Our TalkBack section number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Again, I'm sharing insights and information from Sarah Robinson, Aldernet, and myself. First and foremost, many people who are progressive or liberal believe that there is only a conservative agenda. I believe that it is a corporate agenda, and they're only using people based upon their politics as a justification rationalization. Therefore, both conservative and liberal are waging a war on education, and they continue apace. Now, we can argue the pros and cons of charters, and I see pros and cons in charters, and they're blooming everywhere. But we're also seeing very high-stakes testing cementing its grip on classrooms and legislators and pundits, wondering what need those stupid liberal art colleges are for anyway. Isn't college about job prep? Who needs to know anything about art history and anthropology or ancient Greece? Now think of that today. Aren't these denigrated? Aren't liberal education bastions denigrated? If you want to expand your knowledge of human nature, isn't that considered, stupid? That's the message. Among the den, there's a worrisome trend. Liberals keep affirming right-wing talking points, usually without realizing that they're even right-wing, or saying things like, the education of our children is a nonpartisan issue. Nonsense. It's completely a partisan issue, and it's fully ideological. People who say stuff have no idea what they're talking about. The education of our children is a core cultural and political choice that reflects the deepest differences between liberals and conservatives, because every educational conversation must start with a fundamental philosophical question. So I ask you, what is that question? What is an education for? Now, our answers to that question could not be more diametrically opposed. I'll share the progressive position. It is about human nature. Our beliefs about the purpose of education are rooted in even deeper beliefs about the basic nature of humanity. All the political constructs spring from one central premise. The conservatives in particular, the neocons in particular, believe that human beings are essentially fallen and deeply flawed. Human beings are swayed by uncontrollable passions. We make consistently bad choices, and we are incapable of governing ourselves. Given our basic depravity, civilization can only work if we submit ourselves to the external guidance of society's appointed authorities and stay on the straight and narrow path our betters have clearly marked out with rules, oversight, and punishments. Without these constraints, we cannot be trusted. Our own perverse natures would inevitably lure us into ruin. And we might add on how many religions also have a similar philosophy. George Lakoff pointed out that in this worldview, children are born evil, and it's the duty of the strict father to beat it out of them. For their own good, of course. Kids must learn to accept the boundaries and order imposed by the authorities who've magnanimously consented to responsibility for their wretched and unworthy souls. The main imperative of education is to break the child's will, force him to conform to society's expectations, make him an obedient and compliant employee, and prepare him to survive in a hostile and competitive world that will cut him no breaks. Nobody's going to protect you, for good or bad. You're only going to be given what you earned. What kids need most from school are hard skills and marketable credentials that will enable them to find a stable place in the hierarchy, thus securing their futures. Libertarian education critic John Taylor Gatto has rightly pointed out that the hidden curriculum of public schools is designed from the ground up to reinforce these deeply authoritarian lessons. According to Gatto, the student is trained to eat, sleep, excrete, and think by the bells. No daydreaming about history during math class. She also learns to accept the judgment of teachers, peers, and other worthies who are entitled to evaluate your worth. It's beyond your pay grade to assess your own performance. This lesson fosters a lifelong dependence on external authority and further quashes self-assessment and critical thinking. High-stakes testing is an artifact of the conservative and corporate liberal belief that education is about acquiring a required body of knowledge that's been determined by experts. If it's not in the books, you don't need to know it. And the ultimate outcome, the purpose of this whole process, is to graduate with a credential that will certify your acceptability to the established hierarchies of the economic world. In this model, critical thinking is horrifically dangerous because it teaches kids to reject the assessment of external authorities in favor of their own judgment, a habit of mind that invites opposition and rebellion. This is why, for much of Western history, critical thinking skills have only been taught to the elite students, the ones headed for the professions, who will be entrusted with managing society on behalf of the aristocracy. The aristocracy, of course, are sending their kids to private schools where they will receive a classical education that teaches them everything they will need to remain in charge. Our public schools, unfortunately, have replicated a class stratification on this front that's been in place since the Renaissance. Gatto argues that this kind of regimented education is profoundly inappropriate in a democracy. If you teach a child that he is incapable or intrinsically unworthy of governing himself, a central assumption of this view, then how on earth can he participate in governing his country? The answer, of course, is he can't. And indeed, this is the whole point. And if you doubt me on this point, then ask yourself this. In medicine, I will use this as simply one metaphor. You have 900,000 physicians. You have hundreds of thousands of nurses. You have hospital administrators. You have over 6 million people participating. When was the last time you heard any of these people rally together to address the issue that the number one cause of death in the United States is medicine itself, iatrogenesis, and the number one cause of injury, costing over $500 billion a year, that it is for the profit model that they're all there to support, where if we wanted to really improve our health, we would allow people who have critical evaluations, who are self-motivated, to challenge the existing wrongs within the paradigm and choose rights that will transform us. Hence, we will look at the real causes of an illness and therefore adjust the problem at its causative level. We have refused to do that, and those rare individuals who have chosen in medicine, in nursing, in chiropractic, in any of the professions, in psychology, to challenge the basic tenets of a power system had themselves been riddled, ridiculed, mocked, put on Wikipedia with the quackbusters attacking him and the major media being there not to allow any other assessment. Hence, you're punished in any institution, finance, agriculture, in any institution, if you are critical free thinker. There is no room for you. So everyone graduating with this elitist concept is there to perpetuate their own gains and to solidify the institution so no institution can be reformed. We've had no reform. No institution will change. We've had no change. So what is our option? The only option I can honestly see is the complete and total breakdown of any system before those who are truly progressive and have an interest outside of their own narcissistic and selfish self-interest to come in and rebuild it, or those people wise enough to pull themselves away from existing institutions to rebuild a new paradigm, but always being mocked and ridiculed in the process. Democracy begins with the premise that most people are intrinsically decent and good, and that they can usually be trusted to make the right choices for themselves. Without this humanistic, and I dare say spiritual, belief in people's essential moral and intellectual competence, a system of universal citizenship and collective governance would be philosophically unthinkable and functionally impossible. This assumption also has profound implications for education. Among liberals, the ultimate purpose of both education and parenting is to bring forward the best that lies within us, with the ultimate goal of maximizing the unique potential of each child. The stronger each of us is individually, the stronger civilization is as a whole. Education, therefore, should, above all else, foster self-knowledge and self-discipline, equipping us to make the best possible contributions to the collective and to pursue life, liberty, and happiness wherever those pursuits may take us. It is hoped that they will take us on many unforeseeable adventures, adventures for which we will need to be ready. Then ask yourself how many parents who consider themselves liberal have ended up manifesting nothing but selfish, self-absorbed, narcissistic children, which merely reflects the extension of that parent's own limited perception of their world. So putting a title, monikering yourself with a political or ideological reference point, does not mean that you're in any way living up to a higher standard. Central to this preparation is the development of our internal authority and judgment, which we rely on to guide us through life and make us thoughtful, moral citizens. After all, would we need any form of restraint if we were all raised with the same moral guidelines and chose to honor them? No, we would not. We would have empty prisons, and we would have no fear as we live our lives. It's assumed that people who are accustomed to this kind of personal freedom will also fiercely resist authoritarian leadership. Well, let me ask you, when was the last time Rachel Maddow and all the people on MSNBC who are so defiant in challenging the Republicans but are equally culpable and equally susceptible in their own hubris and dismissiveness of what is truly progressive? When were they in marches and got themselves arrested? When did they protest, including the capacity to lose their own salaries by defining what is an unethical ad on their own television programs? How can you, on the one hand, say you're for children, and on the other hand, see ads that are stigmatizing children as having diseases that do not exist with medications that can cause suicide or chemically lobotomize them? That is the kind of perpetual disconnect that both the left and the right have been engaged in this stupidity for as long as I can think. Now, given this reality, the college's job training model the conservatives and liberals are promoting looks patently insane. Subjects like logic and philosophy, anthropology and rhetoric, foreign languages and history provide the mental flexibility, the deep perspective, and the sharp critical thinking skills that allow one to make one's own way on unfamiliar landscapes, a skill that's useful when the world keeps changing around you. People with rich liberal arts backgrounds are also far better prepared for leadership roles and better positioned to recognize and seize on whatever opportunities fate throws their way. And survival in the economy of the future is going to depend far more heavily on our ability to create and maintain strong, broad social networks, to make and maintain supportive relationships with people who understand your value. It is obvious that stripping these mind-expanding fripperies out of the curriculum, as conservatives and corporate liberals do, are proposing to do, often with no pushback at all from the real liberals and real conservatives, serves the narrow functional conservative and liberal view of education and citizenship very well. But we let them win this point at our peril. It's not exactly accurate, but nonetheless true, to say that the reason we call it liberal education is that the more of it that you have, the more liberal you're likely to be. If we buy into the idea that critical thinking is somehow non-essential, we're not only betraying the entire future of the liberal tradition in America, we're also depriving future generations the basic skills and knowledge they'll need to defend their democracy from the plutocrats and the technocrats that now dominate, these worthless, corrupt, mind-numbingly, absolutely over-budgeted and overpopulated bureaucracies at the federal, state, and local level without a single whiff of complaint from those who think they know what is best. Once you understand how very different our underlying worldviews are, the things we need to do to preserve our idea of a progressive, empowered education becomes far more clear. And once we've gotten a firmer grasp on what our values demand on this issue, the easier it will be to talk about our vision of what America education should be. Let me give you an example. Now, I will not have a chance to take your calls, and I will not have a chance to finish my commentary before we probably run out of time on our 55-minute stations that are carrying us. So you can continue with a great invention called the telephone to listen by calling 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or go online. I want to get this thought across. Let us challenge tests. I am opposed to the way tests are done today. I'm opposed to the constant high-level tutoring, because what you're doing is you're imploring a child or a young person to learn what someone is putting into their mind in a cram fashion without a context to use it in the real world. They just are supposed to test positive to get the grade. But what do they know about the world? As someone who counsels every day, 7 days a week, people at night, I can tell you, I've had corporate leaders, hedge fund owners, I've had top politicians, members of the royal family that I've counseled that sit across from me. And without exception, not one exception, are these people that I would count upon if I wanted to have a conversation with friends about the world we live in. It is axiomatic. These people are only skilled and gifted in what they have mastered, which is very limited to the world they live in. Hence, over-testing to achieve a certain status and be placed in an artificial hierarchy is not constructive. But tests are valuable. They give teachers useful feedback about where each child is and what can be done to improve his or her progress. But they are only a means to an end. Today, all testing at the state level and at the other levels, graduate level, these are not comprehensive. They do not appropriate education. Only totalitarians who reject democratic goals and values can possibly believe that that test are ends to themselves. There is no such thing as a one-size-fits-all education, and no student potential can ever be described by a single number. The same applies to teachers. In a democracy, we find competent people, and then we trust them to do the right thing until they've shown they can't. Teachers deserve at least this much from us. The grinding, constant oversight is an authoritarian response to the deprofessionalization and demoralization, and that is wrong. The metrics used to reward and promote them should reflect the full range of skills they bring to their work and the actual difference they make in the lives of their students. Let's make it easy for really talented people to love this job. And then, for goodness sake, let a teacher teach. The arts, the crafts, the humanities matter. How many times have I spoken with the arrogant, the conceited, who thought if you took arts and crafts or woodwork that you were just too stupid to get in to the better graded schools. From kindergarten through college, we've seen 25 years of deep cuts in music, art, lab science, foreign language, school papers, drama departments, sports programs, home economics, and shop class. All of these classes have one thing in common. They're the hands-on subjects where kids spend the most time thinking independently and exploring their own creativity, experiencing themselves as productive and competent, and gaining confidence in useful real-world skills. What they learn in these classes doesn't show up in the test scores. But these lessons yield adults who take care of themselves in a wide range of situations. You may never use a equation again for the rest of your days, but no matter where you're headed, your life will be forever richer if you know how to informally test an idea, play it on a team, make a satisfying dinner, speak some basic Spanish, handle a wrench and a drill, and write an engaging narrative on a subject you care about. Teamwork matters. Haven't we just gone through 40 years of me, I, mine? At what point does our extreme need for selfishness define the only reason we're alive? What we own, what we possess, what we've gained, how far we've driven ourselves, what we've sacrificed. We've sacrificed our relationships. We sacrifice the relationship with our pets until they're dead, and then we mourn them for a half a heartbeat until the phone rings again. We sacrifice our health. We sacrifice quality of life. We sacrifice even understanding our life. And then one day we wake up and we've achieved something, and then we don't know who it is that's supposed to take credit for it because we are completely clueless about our own authentic identity. And then we wonder why there's an epidemic of suicides in children today. Well, how about these kids never had a chance to fully develop as real societies allow children to develop and to learn everything, to have constant feedback that puts the real life situations in front of them? Do we teach a class on how to fail humanistically? No. Separation? No. Loss? No. Do you ever have a class in school where what do you do when your kid dies? What do you do when your mom and dad divorce? What do you do when you got to go on food stamps? What do you do when you're homeless? Not once. Why? Because this is the real world. I'm looking at 100 million Americans who are on just poverty level and never a class to prepare them. So if you don't prepare someone, then don't be surprised when they're committing suicide or going to drugs or alcohol or eating junk food because it's the only substitute for anything that otherwise would replace the pain of their non-self. Hence, let's get into the we, teamwork. The cooperative skills we learn while playing sports or doing a class project with friends are essential to economic survival in an increasingly interdependent world. High-stakes testing reinforces the conservative message that you're on your own and will rise or fall on your own merit, as defined by external authorities who grade the test. But a truly progressive education focuses us and forces us to teach kids to work together, build relationships, draw on their sense of self-worth from their ability to make strong contributions to the group and society. In the years ahead, which one of these people would you rather be sitting across the table from at a city planning meeting? College isn't just job prep. It's about developing the leaders who will set the standards for our entire culture. When we shortchange students on the liberal arts curriculum, we're dooming the next generation to be led by people whose perspective, vision, flexibility, and insight and compassion aren't up to the highest standards. If you want our nation to be better, we need to train better minds. And for thousands of years, a firm grounding in the arts and humanities have been the main way civilization gained the world that we have described. Discipline is not about control or retribution. It's about encouraging students to make better decisions, exercise some foresight, take responsibility, grow up, and recognize the effects of their action upon themselves and others. If a disciplinary intervention doesn't meet those goals, then it's not effective and shouldn't be used. Vocational education is not for losers. Our country is far better placed because it's well stocked with tradespeople, factory workers, technicians, small business owners, and service providers who have mastered their fields and take pride in their work. These people are the foundation of our economy and the real wealth and job creators. When we shortchange their training or undermine their significance, we are undermining our future competitiveness and completeness. And finally, critical thinking is the birthright of every American. We should not aspire to be a feudal society where only the elites are taught to think independently, evaluate evidence, weigh complex factors, make informal decisions. But it will become one in just the next 2 or 3 years if we stop making this the foundational competence delivered by our educational system. A democracy in which a majority of the people no longer are capable of basic critical thinking skills cannot remain a democracy for long. It is my belief that we are now no longer in a democracy and haven't been for a long time, and that's why we do not have people on a block go out to help their neighbors, to chip in if they have extra money to help them save their home, to see if they're going to have to lose their home, that they have some support. food, clothing, care, compassion, someone to speak with. Instead, we look through closed windows, peek out at someone who is leaving as if it's too bad for them, but we're not going to help. What does that say about our completeness? From Sarah Robinson, Aldernet, I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much for listening.